Blog Talk Radio. Welcome once again to Madame Perry Salon, the podcast with more celebrities than the inauguration. I am your host and groove mistress, Madame Perry, or you can call me Jennifer JP. I'm just happy to be here. And thanks to everybody who tried to listen to last night's show. I had technical difficulties, and I had some problems a week ago, too, that seemed to be linked to some things that... people shopping a lot online or whatever, and the lines were down. But we're here, I'm here, you're here, and we're all ready to groove tonight. And everything's tip-top on the scene, on the studio, everything. Now, I was going to tell you, that Ricky Bird, guitarist for Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, he's a rock and roll Hall of Famer. He sent me some CDs I can give away to you from his new CD, which is Sobering Times. You know, Ricky's been sober about 23 years now, and he's doing work as a counselor. And of course, he calls himself a recovery troubadour. But he and as he said in his last album that he did, he has a song called "I Prefer Waking Up to Coming To." Yeah, so. We love Ricky, and we want to give away his CDs. And so, if you send me a message and answer this question, what guest did I have on my show in the last couple of months that said he is a graduate of zombie school? He graduated from a school, an acting school for zombies. Tell me who that is, and I'll send you Ricky Bird's CD, and I think I've got some stickers he sent with it and stuff like that, some kind of swag. And let's see, what else? Oh, Arden Marine from the show Insatiable. She plays Regina Sinclair on Insatiable. And, you know, Arden was here to talk about her book, Little Miss Little Compton, about her memoir about her life in Little Compton, Rhode Island. And she had some bags made, and she told me, you know, she had some bags designed to go with the book to complement the cover, which is a great cover. And if you order soon, you'll get one of those bags free. My friend Kenya ordered the book, and she got the bag from her and said it is so cute. She put the picture of it up on Instagram. And who else we had? Jamie McCollum, the sociologist, the book Worked Over. He was on here recently. Great show. And also Jerry Mitchell. Don't forget to get his book, Racing Against Time. He was here, I think it was 2 weeks ago. Jerry Mitchell was a journalist and in Mississippi. And after seeing the movie Mississippi Burning, he made it his mission to bring the former Klan members responsible for the deaths of Vernon Dahmer, Medgar Evers, the four young girls that were killed in the church bombing, to bring them to justice. And he worked hard. It took a long time, but he did. And he was a great guest, too. So definitely get his book, Racing Against Time. He's a very interesting fellow. You can find his TED Talk. Oh, last Sunday, or a couple of nights ago, I was a guest on the Peter G. Show. And so if you haven't found him yet, Peter G. Show, it's a television. It's not like mine. You know, you have to get dressed up and put on makeup for that. But I was a guest on his show, and I'm so thankful. So go check him out. He's got a lot of good guests on his shows. He was a musician, so some of his old pals like Steve Lukather and Greg Spillinganes, who you know are on there from time to time. And he's just a great guy. He's a lot of fun. It ended up just feeling like a party. Well, tonight's guest is somebody I told him yesterday I'd been reading his books for 20 years. When I think about it, I think it's more like 25 or longer. But I am a longtime fan of his work. He is a philosopher, psychologist, actually a forensic psychologist, an MD, and he has written several books. But he's best known by a lot of people for his books or his research on people who have had near-death experiences, which is actually, he coined the term near-death experience. And you may have read his book, Life After Life. And I tell you what, let's just go ahead. It's his first time in the genie bottle, so I want him to feel comfortable. And let's welcome for the first time to Madame Perry's Salon. And I don't think he heard me before. This is a podcast with more celebrities than the inauguration. So, of course, I have to welcome Dr. Raymond Moody. Hi there.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
I am absolutely thrilled to have you here. I've just been reading you so long, and I cherish
Well, I'm a slow
moment.
Reader myself, so Just kidding.
Are you having a hectic time at the holidays, or is it pretty mellow around your household?
Oh yeah, you know something, Madam Perry, you will learn at age 76. Things smooth out; they really do. I was a kind of driven person in a way. I got my PhD in philosophy when I was 24. Then I taught philosophy for 3 years. Then I went to medical school, and I had 2 doctoral degrees by the time I was 31. And so, you know, you're old enough to appreciate that there was something really wrong with somebody who would have 2 doctoral degrees by age 31. And there definitely was. I was just, you know, I just felt driven. And I have had an experience, though, as I've grown older. I heard Goldie Hawn say one time, she said that she had 7 years of psychoanalysis, and she said what her psychoanalysis did for her was that it changed her from a driven person to a driving person. And I kind of feel like that. It seemed like before everything was pushing me from behind, but now it's just like I do things just because I want to do them, and I actually get a lot more done. And plus, I've got 2 kids still at home, and that, you know, just as you grow older, no matter how uptight and driven you were when you were younger, you do tend to mellow out. So, yeah, we're having a good time this holiday.
Yeah, the things that used to be so earth-shattering, just kind of like, well, I can live with that.
Yes. You know, and I've seen so much. And also, you know, after all those people I've talked to, it's literally thousands since I first heard about this when I was an undergraduate student in 1962 by reading about it in Plato. And then 3 years later, I met an actual living person, Dr. George Ritchie, who had that experience. And since that time, I've talked with thousands of people who, you know, went to the brink of death, many of them cardiac arrest from which they were resuscitated. And I just didn't know what to make of it. You know, I did not come from a religious environment. And Plato was the first person I ever knew who took the idea of an afterlife seriously. But I appreciated that these people were sincere and were describing the same thing, but I just didn't know whether it meant life after death or not. I never bought into that idea that it's oxygen deprivation to the brain, because during my first year in medical school, one of my own professors told me that when she had been trying unsuccessfully to resuscitate her own mother, she herself got out of her body and lifted up and saw the scene from above and saw her mother in spirit form, as she put it, and saw her mother recede off into this tunnel and into a light and so on, and saw relatives and friends of her mother's who had already died, who was there to meet her mother. And so, you know, my professor wasn't ill or injured. There was no question of oxygen cut off to her brain. And yet she had identically the same experience. And subsequently, I've talked to you know, hundreds and hundreds of people who say that they had the same thing of leaving their body and going into a light and seeing, you know, relatives and friends, apparitions, and yet they weren't ill or injured. They were just there when somebody else was passing away. So, and I just finally, just a few years ago, just sort of threw up my hands and said, well, you know, to my utter astonishment, there is an afterlife. And life is still tough, you know. I mean, it's scary, but at the same time, I've really mellowed out in the last few years. So, you know, I don't know. I just feel like I wish I had been this way earlier in my life. Yeah.
Well, when you first started hearing people, when people shared stories like that with you, when you first heard such stories, when did you start to get curious enough to study it?
Well, I tell you the truth. It was, I went to University of Virginia from Macon, Georgia, in at the age of 18 in 1962, and I went there resolute on studying astronomy. But I took a philosophy course, and I just reading Plato, I was hooked. You know, I mean, the name Plato hits with a dull thud to many people. But, you know, I always used to ask my students when I was a professor of philosophy and I was trying to teach them Plato, I said, like, why do you think this guy's writings have been in print for 2,300 years, you know? And so, you know, I mean, it's just really amazing stuff. And when I read that in Plato's Republic, that this story of a man who was bleed to death on the battlefield but revived and told the story of getting out of his body and going through a passageway into another world, then I asked my professor, Professor Hammond, about this. And he said that the early Greek philosophers studied cases like that, people who were believed dead and revived and had these experiences. And that was enough to get me interested in it because, you know, the idea of an afterlife was so counterintuitive to me. But the idea that Plato would take it seriously was impressive. And then 3 years later, I met this Dr. George Ritchie, who at that time was a professor of psychiatry there at UVA, and he had that experience. And so that, you know, just as soon as I heard George Ritchie, who's the finest person I ever knew, actually, and I knew that he was sincere. And so that got me interested. And then when I taught at East Carolina University, I taught philosophy, and I began to hear this from my colleagues and from students and so on. And, you know, it's inherently fascinating, really, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So I got, as soon as I realized that there's plenty of people like this to talk to, I started talking with them.
Now, you are known as the man who coined the term near-death experience.
Well, that's right. And it wasn't much of a leap. I mean, you know, it didn't seem right to call them death experiences because the people got back, right?
Oh, right.
But we do say, you know, people, we talk about people being near death. So that was, you know, what I came up with. I had flirted with calling them perimortal visionary experiences, but I told my one of my professors, Russ Moore, is over there at the Medical College of Georgia. And he said, no, that's too medical. So and he was right. But you know, I think that really what I sort of think of the importance of that book was that I talked about the characteristics of them, you know, like the getting out of the body and going through a passageway and having one's life in review and meeting one's dead relatives and then having various ways of coming back and so on. I thought that was, you know, in terms of nobody had ever realized that there was a common pattern in these experiences. So that was what I was so interested in when I published the book.
And these were people who didn't know each other, who had never heard each other's story.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And at that time, see, it wasn't, you know, nobody had sort of figured out the common pattern. And the reason I think that that book got, you know, since it's been going on since antiquity, why would it suddenly attract attention in 1974 and 5? Well, the reason was that by then, see, they had developed techniques of cardiopulmonary resuscitation to such a degree that many, many people were coming back, whereas though it happened in the ancient world, the number of people who survived that were few and far between. But in the, you know, 60s and 70s, just with all that CPR, there were just many more people. And I noticed at first I started going to these civic clubs in Greenville, North Carolina, and later Augusta, Georgia, because, you know, those – and then it was an all-male province, you know, but the Rotarians and the Lions Club and the Kiwanis and all – and, you know, they have to have a speaker every Tuesday or Wednesday, so, you know, I mean, as soon as I went to one, I'd be invited to all of them. And what I – noticed, and these were the movers and shakers in these towns, right? But, you know, it invariably, after I would talk about this, two or three, or in one case, one of these meetings, seven different guys came up afterward and said, "Dr. Moody, I've never told anybody this, but." And so I quickly realized that people all talked about, oh, how courageous you were to bring this out. Well, I'm not courageous at all. But by the time that book published, I realized that anybody who wanted to check me out would find plenty of cases for themselves. It was just so common. And so, you know, but I was surprised that it got all the attention like it did. Yeah.
And so it seemed like there were so many people who had this story, and then I imagine they were cautious, but then excited so that they could go ahead and speak up and not be run out of town.
That's exactly right. That's a very good term, cautious. You know, that was a very common thing I heard back then. It was, "Dr. Moody, I've never told anybody this, but." And, and you know, I had a number of people who told me the same thing, that they would, when they got resuscitated, they would try to tell the doctor about this, but the doctor would say, "Oh, that's a hallucination, don't talk about it," or else would say, "Well, you know, that's kind of out of my bailiwick, you better talk to your minister about that." But then some of these people said, then they would go to their minister and try to tell the minister, and the minister said, "Well, that's out of my territory, you better talk to your doctor about that." And that was a very common thing I heard. So, but nowadays, you know, it's generally known. So, you know, people are less reluctant now to talk about what happened to them.
So then people feel like there really is more something like, well, there is some confirmed evidence that you can tap into a universal knowledge.
Well, I've heard that said. And I still am, my areas in philosophy were logic and philosophy of language. So I'm so mundane in one way, you know, and I'm still kind of going by the old way of learning, by reading books and stuff. And yet at the same time, I hear this from people all the time and in these extremely lengthy cardiac arrests that go on, you know, the books say 5 minutes. Well, ho, ho, you know, I've known people who were apparently dead for hours and yet, you know, are still very coherent and everything. And, you know, I'm just always realized throughout my life that there's a lot of stuff I don't know and probably can't know. But the ones with these extremely lengthy cardiac arrests say that they become aware of what seems to be a whole dimension of knowledge where people are just sort of pursuing the quest for knowledge. And one man said it was, if you try to imagine MIT and Caltech and, you know, Harvard and Yale and Princeton and all of them just squeezed into one, he said you still couldn't even begin to imagine what this place is like. So in that sense, that's what I hear from people, that You know, that knowledge seems to be part of it. When people go through these life reviews, it's really interesting. That was one of the first things that was really interesting to me. And later on, in doing my psychiatry training, I quickly became aware, and, you know, having therapy patients and so on, that everybody seems to be chasing something, right? Like some are chasing power or money or fame or, as in my case, you know, whatever, knowledge. But whatever they were chasing, they said when they saw this review of their life in which everything they had ever done appeared around them in a panorama instantaneously, like time sort of stood still. And when they saw all these things they had done, they remembered it, but also that they were empathically embodied or embedded in the consciousness of the people with whom they've interacted. So in this situation, if you see yourself doing something mean to somebody, then you feel the hurt directly. Or if you see yourself doing a kind-hearted action to someone else, then you feel the good feelings. And this is often conducted in the presence of what they call a being of light. You know, some say Christ or Jesus, or others say God or an angel or a being of light. But they say that this presence can see everything they've ever done and yet loves them completely. And so they come out of this, whatever they were chasing before, saying that what this is all about while we're here is to learn to love. And that's a sort of universal message that comes from this. And also, during that case, a lot of people have told me that that when scenes appear in which they have been learning something, that this presence kind of focuses in on this. And people say you don't hear words in all this. It's beyond words, but they say it's like the thought comes that even after you die, this process of knowledge will continue. And I've had a lot of people actually say, you know, the process of learning, as far as they can tell, is eternal. You go on and on and on learning. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this is a good time for me to stop and say, if you are listening to us live tonight, and this is December 23rd, 2020 at 8:22 p.m. Eastern, if you're listening live and you would like to talk to Dr. Raymond Moody, if you have a question or something you want to talk to him about, you can give us a call at 646-716-9922. And that is a toll-free call in the continental U.S. It's 646-716-9922. And for people who can't make a phone call, maybe they're at a job, they got to be quiet or something, you know, you can always send me the message on Facebook, either via Madam Perry Salon or my page, Jennifer Maudette Perry, and I will be happy to share it with Dr. Moody. Okay. All right. So, yeah, you're talking about the life reviews, and then they, after that, when they come back, are they changed? Do they feel like they change in appreciation of life?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, they say that, number one, they don't have any more fear of death. Now, yeah, not that people would die in an unpleasant way, but they all say that this gives them the absolute, unshakable conviction that death is the transition to another state of existence, kind of. And also they say that it shows you that really what this is all about is learning to love. It's kind of an educational program we're going through. And frustratingly, they say that even though you see this, you see all the things you've done and how they hurt people or helped people, but that even after this, that it's very hard, as I like to say, to get through the average day without wanting to choke at least one person. In other words, you're still a human being. And that yet you've had this. And I will say, after knowing thousands of people like this, they do a pretty good job. I mean, I think that one of the common things you see with people who've been through this is that it puts them on a life course of trying to, you know, a spiritual quest kind of. And My friend, Dr. George Ritchie, the first person I ever knew, had this. He used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning every day and pray and meditate before he went to see his patients. And George was just a thoroughly fine person, you know. And so it does, it has a big impact on people.
Hmm. Now, there was another, in Glimpses of Eternity, I think that's the book where you first started talking about shared death experiences.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And I knew about these all along. But, you know, after when Life After Life was published, I was right into my psychiatry residency and didn't have much time anymore for writing books. But I just kept on working on this and gathered lots of cases of people who had the same experience that I've described, except they weren't themselves ill or injured. They were just there in the presence of somebody else who died. And all of these things that, you know, you hear from the near-death experience also occur sometimes to the bystanders who say, for example, as grandma died, I myself got out of my body and went part way toward this light with her. Or people say that if somebody's dying, the whole room seems to fill up with light. Or people will report seeing apparitions of the deceased coming into the room where a person is dying. I saw that quite a bit in medical school and residency, where the nurses who knew that I was sympathetic to this would talk to me about seeing apparitions of the dying people in there, and you know, in the presence of people who were passing away. And most remarkably of all, I have a lot of cases where the bystander actually empathically co-lived the dying life review of the person, which to me, I think that's probably the most troubling thing I know about this, because, you know, I'm even hoping to recuse myself from my own life review, much less the idea that there would be a spectator, right? And so that is troubling to me in a way. And yet what people tell me is that, no, it's really perfectly natural, because I guess, you know, I learned as a psychiatrist, we all pretty much have the same secrets, right? So, you know, most
pretty
of the
much.
Things you see there. Yeah. And for a long time, I thought, well, surely this had to be something who was somebody who was very intimately connected with the dying person. And then a few years ago, my wife and I got a communication from a physician who was called to the ER to resuscitate a patient. He had never laid eyes on this man, but he said as the man was dying that he saw this holographic or panoramic life review of the man unfold. So it's, you know, life is a very curious phenomenon. And I guess, you know, I mean, so I don't want to be sound like I'm monopolizing this. I mean, I subsequent to my book, physicians all over the world have reported this same thing. There are lots of other psychiatrists and psychologists and medical doctors who've investigated this and found this same thing. It's just, it's very common among patients who get resuscitated from close calls with death.
So when they, do they seem to have a, and you may have already mentioned this, do most of these people come back, you said they're not as afraid of death anymore.
Yeah.
They come back calm? Maybe it's
well,
excited,
I would say so. Yeah, well, that's an interest. I don't know that I've ever thought about it before like that, but yes. Yeah, by and large, the people I've known do convey that sort of very quality of some, sort of a calmness that comes over them. I guess you probably have heard of Eben Alexander. Eben, it was 15 years, was a professor of neurosurgery at Harvard. And, you know, you have to be pretty hard driving to be a professor of neurosurgery at Harvard. But Eben is just really just so calm and laid back, and I didn't know him before he had his own near-death experience some years ago, but just, you know, an utterly delightful human being in every way.
I am going to pause just a moment so that maybe Dr. Moody can get another glass of water, and so can I. I'm going to play a little message, and we'll be right back. And remember, if you've got a message, just message it to me. If you have a call, I mean, excuse me, a question or a comment for him, or you can call 646-716-9922. And here's just a little message.
So, Chuck, talk to us about Fizdale being the Knicks' new coach. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll tell you right now, Ernie, it don't matter who's going to coach this team. They don't got no talent on
we
it. And I don't really feel I talk.
That's kind of hard.
I don't feel I talk about the Knicks right
don't
now.
Want to talk about lunch?
No.
What would you like to talk about, Chuck?
See, Ernie, I've been listening to a podcast called Madam Perry Salon. And I think Jennifer Perry, she's a great host. I mean, she got all these bestseller authors, Rostov, and all the comedians.
What about people that don't have rings?
Here we go again.
Real funny, man. Real funny. But I think she's great, and I think people would love her show. She got a great laugh. She make the laugh come out of nowhere like an eagle come in there and just steal the whole show. It's a beautiful thing. It's not terrible.
All right. You know, sometimes, Dr. Moody, not terrible is the best I can hope for and feel good about it, too.
Yeah, well, you know, I tell you, Madam Perry, I got to say this, that there's a lot of stuff in psychology about, you know, self-esteem and the importance of self-esteem. Well, what I've learned in my life tells me the direct opposite. I try to keep my self-esteem as low as possible because, you know, ego is the really, like, my ego trip was jealousy, right? And I think that you only need one ego trip. And to me, you know, if I was saying that I had abandoned my ego because I laid on the bed of nails and burned the incense and climbed up the mountain or whatever, that would be egotistical. But the reason I pretty much surrendered my ego is that I almost killed myself with it, you know. And, you know, ego, it's a formula I've used all over the world. And just like people just immediately relate to this. To me, the equation is ego equals pain. Right? And think about it. Whenever your ego is involved, it's always some painful situation, right? So I'm not much on self-esteem. I try to keep myself, you know, just trying to, I don't want to have self-esteem. I would rather have a realistic assessment of the world and myself.
Okay. Well, yeah, that makes sense. I'm not laughing at you. Somebody's asking me, Kristen has just said that she's enjoying the show, but she would like to hear you talk more about your experiences. Have you had an experience with this?
Well, no, really. I came close to death one time. I had undiagnosed thyroid disease, which went on for 25 years, as they can tell by my medical records, and it ended up in a horrible situation called myxedema, which is profound hypothyroidism, and I almost died, but I didn't have the real full-blown near-death experience. But I've definitely had experiences in my life that wake you up to, you know, as a logician, I have to acknowledge that you can't prove any of these things by a logical proof. But there's certain things that happen to you in life. You just, you know, you just come to accept inside yourself that there's other things. I have almost finished a book called God is Bigger Than the Bible. And it's going to come out in about a month or so. I'm kind of writing the last part of the last chapter now. And I never really had much interest in religion. And I can't say that I was an atheist, like entertaining the idea that there is no God. To me, it was just like it was a non-issue, like I did. I guess I sort of assumed that you couldn't know that there is or isn't a God. But hearing these people with near-death experiences sort of woke me up to that. side of life. And then prayer came along, and I've had these amazing experiences with prayer that, well, for example, back in 1990, I moved into mill that had been built in 1839, and it was last rewired in 1950, 40 years before. Well, I knew it needed rewiring, but didn't have the money at the time. So 3 years and 4 months passed, and in September of 1993, my wife one day said, well, we can get the money together now for a rewiring, but we didn't have any, we didn't know any electrician. So I swear to God, the following events happened. My wife and I held hands by our kitchen sink, and we prayed that God would send us just the right electrician. Okay. The next morning, the phone rang, and Cheryl picked up the phone and said, hello, and a voice on the other end said, hello, this is B.R. Wilson. Cheryl said, yes, B.R., what is it? And he said, well, your number just came up on my beeper. And Cheryl said, well, we haven't had any, we made any phone calls this morning, BR. What's this all about? And he said, well, I'm an electrician. And Cheryl said, well, come on over, BR. We do need an electrician. So to make a long story short, he went around, he did his inspection, and then he was going out, and Cheryl was putting him in his van, and he said, well, it's going to be a few days before I can get out here to do this, because he said, I come from a real close family around here, and we all love each other very much. And he said, and my 38-year-old brother dropped in of a heart attack the other day, and my mother had a heart attack on the way home from the funeral home. So Cheryl said, well, BR, my husband might be able to help you with that. He talks with people who've been through that kind of thing. And BR said, well, my mother gave me this book called Life After Life to read, and it's helping some.
Really?
Now, yeah. Not only that, but BR is still our friend after, 27 years. So my point is, prayer and mm-hmm. I just, somebody asked me, do you believe that God exists? I say, no, absolutely not. Because number one, I, Raymond Moody, am a very limited human being, and any belief that I could form about God would be bound to be off base in one dimension or another. Plus, if you think of that sentence, do you believe that God exists? The emphasis of that sentence is on the word exist, not on God. But as a logician, I could sit down and take about an hour, but I could go through explain what the concept of existence means and even show you how to symbolize it. But when it comes to God, see, I think God is bigger than existence. That, to try to lasso God and put him in a human concept like existence, mm-hmm. I mean, that's... And so what I say is I have a relationship with God is the way I look at it. And, you pray for things, and prayer does affect the outcome. It really, and I'm not religious, by the way. And I do, that is experiences like that. And I guess a real experience back in 1991 of actually feeling the presence of God during a time of turmoil in my life. And so, yeah, that kind of thing I've had, but I haven't had in like a classic near-death experience. But plenty of experiences that wake me up to the reality that this thing we're in is, it's kind of an illusion. And, and if you're in your 70s, you just listen to this and you say, yeah, he's right. But younger people, they probably sounds psychotic to them. But the older you get, the more you realize that, this life that we're in is not what it seems to be. It's kind of a story. Yeah. You're a little too young to remember, but Elie Wiesel.
I'm just a kid.
You're 10 years younger than me. So, but anyway.
No. I'm 30 years younger than you. This is on radio, okay?
Oh, okay. Gotcha. But,
Jeez, Doc.
Yeah, but gotcha. But it's you know, it's I did a year of geriatric psychiatry, and I was in my early 30s then, and they had this clinic where, you know, the people who run the town, they can't come to the psychiatric clinic like the rest of us peons that come in the front door. They have to go in the back door through, you know, and so. Plus, I was older than the other residents, and I was, you know, known for my books. So I was the electee to go in there and do that. And so for about a year, I had the wonderful experience of talking with these old people who were the very accomplished people. And I heard repeatedly them saying words to the effect, like, you know, Raymond, the older I get, the more I get this uncanny impression when I look back on my life that it's been a kind of script or story or movie or drama or whatever they say. And people do develop that. I used to wonder, well, is that just around this town, or is that a, you know, is it a folk belief around here? But then I heard Joseph Campbell, the famous mythologist, say the same mm-hmm. thing on one of his programs.
Ah,
and it,
yeah.
it is, you know, it's, you know, that's what people come to see. You, the older you get, you see the sort of story perspective on life or the narrative perspective. And Elie Wiesel, but he, when I was yeah. a kid, he was a Nobel Prize winning writer, and he said, God made man because he loves stories. And I think that's what this life is all about, where these different stories we live through. And that's so, you know, it's life is dramatic. Even your consciousness, you know, your consciousness puts things together in story form, right? Like
yeah.
when something new happens to you, you weave it into your life story.
True, very true.
Yeah,
I got a couple of other things I want to ask you about, but Vinny from North Carolina.
I already sell Amway products, so if that's hey, I'm just kidding.
How about essential oils? Okay.
Oh yeah, well that's the new one.
All right, Vinny from Asheville wants to know: did the guy fix the electricity? You kind of, she said,
oh,
you left
yeah,
her hanging on
good.
That story.
Well, yeah,
okay.
No, we got a good electrician, but we also, even more importantly, we got a good friend out of that.
Okay.
Yeah, you did.
I've got to, there's a couple more things I want to cover while we're here. I'm going to tell you what both of them are. But by the way, we had your colleague Lisa Smart here a couple of weeks ago, and she was wonderful.
Yeah.
She is.
Yeah.
Two things I want to ask are about art, and this is one would be, I'll let you decide where to start. One would be in your book Coming Back, you talk
uh-huh.
about people asking you about reincarnation and regression
yeah,
hypnosis, past
yeah.
life. And the other thing I want to ask you too is, I read one of your books years ago about reading, and when I say I read it 25 years ago, what I mean was I was a prodigy. I was in
mm-hmm.
kindergarten and reading then, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You have to remember. Okay. About the value of a crystal ball and gazing and mirroring.
Yeah, yeah.
So either one of those you want to start with,
yeah.
reincarnation and then to the crystal ball?
Yeah, well, I guess reincarnation. Yeah, when I wrote that book, the reason I wrote that book actually was that all of my students, I was a psychology professor at that time, and there was a kind of fad on past life regression. So my students just wanted me to do it for them, and I did. I did several hundred people over a period of time, but not with any believing sense of it. I mean, I just didn't know. But, you know, I found out that it's, these past life regressions are very different from what the standard belief is. Like people say, oh, everybody is always Napoleon or Cleopatra, right? And that these people who do this are very histrionic. But that was just not true. And I was impressed by this. But it never led me to think that there really is reincarnation. But where I've come subsequently on that has been with my own kids. And, you know, my wife and I don't take our kids to religious services. We lived in Alabama and we were afraid of snakes. But, hey, that was a joke that way. But we just didn't, you know, we didn't take the kids to religious things, or, and we don't talk about life after death at home. We talk about the news and you know, the what's for dinner and how to pay the phone bill and the kids' homework. And, you know, it's, I'm not at home, I'm not an expert on life after death. I'm just a dad and a husband. But even within that context, and since these were both adopted at birth, Carter is now 22 and Carol Ann is 20. And so I had, by then I was more observant, you know, and I, both of my kids just kind of out of nowhere brought this up about, and in ways that it was almost chilling. My son Carter, who's now 22, when he was 5, we were watching TV and I was flipping through the channels, and I flipped through what turned out to be the National Geographic channel. And so I flipped it back because he was like, he got very animated. Like when I flipped through that channel, he said, Dad, that's my village. So I flipped it back, and it was a documentary on Chinese village life. And Carter started saying, yeah, Dad. He said, it's like, before I came to you and Mommy, I lived in China with my other Mommy and Daddy and other brothers and sisters. And so I was just, you know, perplexed, and as though to, then he went on, and then he could tell that I was kind of disoriented. So then, as though to ground me, he said, yeah. He said, and then I was up in the trees looking down at you and Mommy lying in the grass. And I knew exactly what he had was talking about, because what the event he was describing was, my wife and I were in Greece and we were at a archaeological site, and we had just gotten off the plane a day or so early and we were exhausted. And the attendant at this place said, yeah, just lie there in the grass and have a nap. And we were talking about adopting a baby, you know. And so, yeah, and my daughter too. And so, yeah, I kind of think that what this is all about, you just live through one story and then you go through this incomprehensible process, mm-hmm. and then you're back on another story. And so that's kind of where I've come to on my thinking about reincarnation. But you ask about the crystal ball. This is my interest in this comes from, I am such a bore, really, because to tell you the truth, all of the things that I'm known for trace back to ancient Greek philosophy. And, you know, people say, well, reincarnation came here from the East in the 19th century and so on. Well, that just shows they haven't read about the history of Western thought, because reincarnation was in Western thought from the very beginning. Like Pythagoras and Plato were reincarnationists and so on. So that was kind of my interest there. But in terms of this thing, the crystal ball, the way most people know about that, which is what I had assumed, was that it was a hoax, right? And there was always the cartoon of the gypsy woman gazing into the crystal ball in the tent, right? And so that was my thought about it until I was a professor of psychology and back in 1985. And, you know, a lot of my students were like 18 and 19, 20 years old. They were there because they had to take a course in psychology, or some of them were interested in psychology, right? Well, in terms of talking about the unconscious mind, when you get to a certain age, that's just a fact of experience, right? You realize that, like, how did I get into that same relationship with 5 different people, right? And so, you know, you realize eventually that you have these unconscious patterns in you. But try getting that across to a 17 or 18 or 19-year-old, right? And so that the unconscious, to them, it sounds mythical. Or even if they're hip to psychology, it's still just intellectualized. So what happened was I was in this bookstore and a book fell off the shelf, and it was on crystal gazing. It was published in 1905. And I picked it up, and it is an actual psychological phenomenon. Like many people, when they gaze into what's called an optical clear depth, that can be a crystal ball or a mirror that you shade so that you don't see reflections in it, or just a basin full of water. You can take a silver bowl and polish it on the inside and fill it with water and get in a darkened room by candlelight. And many people under those circumstances will see visions. And you're not making them up. I mean, it's just like you don't have any control of them. They just sort of appear and come and of their own accord. It almost seems to have a life of their own. You see people and historical scenes and spectacular scenery, all kinds of things. And so I used it to try to, but I'd tell the students about this one day, and then the next class they'd come and they would sit around a table and everybody would look. And then we did that for like 30 minutes, and then we would stop and I'd get the students to tell about what they saw. And so that makes them realize, see, that there's an unconscious mind, right? Because they were realizing that, well, I didn't think that and just make it happen automatically, that there's parts of me that I don't know about. So that was why I was using it in my psychology classes. But in about 1988, strange as it may seem, we put logic over on one side of the spectrum, and then on the other side of the spectrum we put spiritual things, right? That's just how we think. But in historical reality, one of the most interesting facts I know is that if you look at the history of ancient Greek philosophy, it's just about the most fascinating story of history. And these early Greek philosophers were involved in these places called oracles of the dead, where you would go and you would go through procedures during which you would actually seem to see and converse with the spirits of the dead. And I had learned about this in college through the historians like Herodotus and all, and wrote about it. But it never entered my mind that it might be something actual. I thought it was just legendary. But in 1988, I read an article in a classical journal about how they had rediscovered and excavated one of these ancient oracles of the dead. And so based on what the archaeologist found there, which was underground chamber where they had a big cauldron surrounded by a banister. And as soon as I read that detail, I realized what they were doing. And they'd go through some preparation process, and then this last day you would get it. There were torch marks on the walls of this place, showing that they illuminated it by torchlight. And I knew already that under those circumstances that people actually do see visions. So I figured they were just, they were preparing people by getting them to talk about the person who died and so on. And then I set it up myself, and it works. I've guided hundreds of people through this, and it's not just me. Other investigators read my report on it and have tried the same thing. It's remarkably easy to set up a circumstance and an apparatus where you go through a procedure and you actually do seem to converse and feel the presence of deceased relatives. And I don't do it anymore because, my interest in it was just to confirm that that's what they were doing at these oracles of the dead, mm-hmm. that was so important in the history of early Greek philosophy.
Right.
But subsequently it's been used to, as it used to, it was used in the Middle Ages as a even as a therapeutic modality for severe grief responses and so on.
Yeah, and I was going to say, you know, you talk about that, about the psychomanteums, the oracles in your book, Reunions, Visionary Counters, Departed Loved Ones. And I want to stop now to say, by the way, folks, you could get his books on his website, Life After Life. It's called lifeafterlife.com. That's the website for Dr. Raymond Moody. And also Lisa Smart, if you heard her a few weeks ago here, you can get her books there as well and know what kind of things they have going on. Dr. Moody, you keep up with the... You're up to date with all the trends. You're even doing virtual shows. And I wanted to ask you, first let me name your books, Life After Life, The Light Beyond, Glimpses of Eternity, Coming Back, Paranormal, My Life in the Pursuit of Afterlife, Reunion, Visionary Encounters with the Departed Loved Ones, and you've got, what, the newest, Making Sense of Nonsense. And you know, you were telling, what are the whimsical writings of Dr. Seuss have in common with near-death experiences?
Yes, that's really the key. It's, you know, Madam Perry, there is a, one thing I can demonstrate for sure is that there is a sort of collective cognitive flaw that's built into our cognitive architecture that kind of keeps us from thinking logically about life after death and some other big questions. And it has to do with the fact that, number one, people love nonsense. I mean, Dr. Seuss's books have sold over 600 million copies. And everybody of my age remembers doo-wop music, right? Like sha-na-na-na-na-na. And, people remember Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong and scat singing, which is just nonsense syllables. Or people in certain religious ceremonies do the glossolalia, which is nonsense syllables, continued to bring about an ecstatic state. So people love nonsense. That's just a reality, like playground rhymes and all, and Lewis Carroll and so on and so on. But people don't like the word nonsense. And so what this has a very paradoxical effect of sort of closing down a whole area of your mind. And this sounds so extraordinary, but I've taught courses on this since 1969, and you can actually take people through a mental process where they will realize that nonsense itself has a structure, that it's not just something unformed. A matter of fact, paradoxically, nonsense is a more complex form of language than ordinary meaningful language. So I just put this all together in my book, Making Sense of Nonsense, which is all the exercises I used in my courses. And it gives examples of nonsense and the 70 different types of nonsense that I've been able to catalog and so on. And the end result of this in terms of near-death experiences is that people with near-death experiences, no matter how articulate they are, they say, I just can't describe it to you, right? Well, what I've done is I've worked a workaround where people can learn how to think about things that don't make sense. And then subsequently, when they happen to have a near-death experience, it gives them a whole new way of talking about it. So that's kind of my current research. And, I mean, that's not the only reason for doing it. Nonsense is important in medicine and psychiatry and religion, and even advertising uses a lot of nonsense because people actually, paradoxically, they'll pay more attention to nonsense than to ordinary meaningful language. So that's what my latest book is all about, and I've had a lot of success with it. It's a subject I was interested in since childhood. I've always been a Dr. Seuss and Lewis Carroll fan, and so I finally got to put all my thoughts about it together in that book.
And I've just started that, so I'm looking forward to reading the whole book. Lewis Carroll, or the Reverend Charles Lutwidge Dodgson.
Yes. And you know, the fact that Dr. Seuss has sold 600 million copies of his books, that means that people like nonsense, right? Right. My favorite line from him actually is, it's one of his books called On Beyond Zebra, where he parodies ABC books. And it begins, "In the places I go, there are things that I see, which I never could spell if I stopped with the Z. I'm telling you this because you're one of my friends. My alphabet starts where your alphabet ends."
Ooh.
Yeah, that's kind of mind-boggling. Yeah. And what he's getting at, which is a reality, is that nonsense is actually a good way to get into spiritual consciousness. You can do all kinds of things like koans, for example. What is the sound of one hand clapping? The point of that is to set the student off on a try to solve that logically, but when you do, you eventually get to the point where it flips you into a whole realm of consciousness beyond the logical, which is the same thing as in glossolalia or speaking in unknown tongues, where people just sort of jabber away in nonsense. But it eventually does bring about I've tried it myself, not in a religious ceremony, but I've tried it. And you know, after a while, you just jabber away, and eventually you do get into this very, very extraordinary state of consciousness that it brings about.
I wonder if scat singing and jazz could do the same thing.
Well, that's what, yeah. When I was a professor at East Carolina, I used to bring Ella Fitzgerald's and other, Al Jarreau was another one, but all these singers who, and doo-wop music too, which is a combination of nonsense and meaningful parts. And you can very easily show in a situation like that that these things bring about profound altered states of consciousness. And that's why kids do it so often. You know, there's a playground rhyme that a lot of people remember is, "One bright day in the middle of the night, two dead boys got up to fight. Back to back they faced each other, drew their swords and shot each other. A blind man came to see the fray, a dumb man came to shout hooray. A deaf policeman heard the noise and came and killed those two dead boys." And, you know, I've just over the years studied that, and it's like people have the most profound childhood memories of this. And, you know, this nonsense makes a big impression on people. And we've kind of ignored it just because we don't like the word. But once you really start studying the structure of nonsense, you see that it has all kinds of medical and psychological and literary dimensions and commercial dimensions as well. It's I have a friend who's an advertising agent, says that it's one of the most common, you know, one of the most powerful ways of getting attention is to put nonsense in the commercials. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, if you remember the latest one is the one that you remember, Bada Book, Bada Boom. That was all it was. And, that, you know, they went on with that one for a year, and it was just nonsense. But it's a very paradoxical thing, but people will actually pay more attention to you if you're talking nonsense than if you're talking regular meaningful language. In Atlanta, there was this guy, what was it, Durwood Fincher. He was from Macon originally, but he was he performed this double talk act, and it's like a very wonderful entertainer.
A double talk? Was that those things kind of like Render Seller and her Three Susty Igglers?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like you use it in the interrogative mood. "Excuse me, sir, can you tell me where the Warbitzer and the Sarbitzo?" And people will really, and what happens with double talk is very predictable. People assume that you're making sense, but there must be something wrong with them, right? That they're having trouble hearing or that they're losing their minds. So it's a very powerful. I know also that they use it in interrogation when you're trying to break down suspects. This is sort of leaked through, or break down people for information. Asking people nonsense questions is a very powerful mind-bending technique because since it's a question form, you feel like you have to answer, right? But
right,
there's not any sense made, so it can be very stressful to people. Yeah.
Oh, Dr. Moody, I know I've kept you longer than you probably meant to be here.
Not at all. Not at all. To the contrary, I'm just really have enjoyed this so much. Thank you so much for having me on the program, and thanks for all the people listening in too. I'm just really, happy that. I just hope people enjoyed tonight.
They are. I've got a message from Tony in Tennessee, and he says, great show. I've always liked his books and like them even more now that I've heard his explanations. So thank you, Tony.
Thank you so much, Tony. Thank you very much.
Also, Scott in Arizona says, great show. Another great guest. Thank you so much. I am already a fan of Dr. Moody. So thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Yeah.
That's very nice. Thanks, Scott. Hope things are good in Arizona. So, yeah, that's a good show. And then who else? And then Patrick in Maryland sent me a big thumbs up and said, good one, good show.
Oh, great.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, Patrick in Maryland, too.
And, yeah, well, this has been great. And like I said, I'm just so thankful. I never thought I'd get a chance to talk to you, and I'm so grateful that you did. And hope you have a lovely holiday. I don't know what you're doing. I'm kind of like you. I'm scared of churches. I'm not just scared of the snakes. I'm scared of something trying to do laying on hands prayer.
Yeah. Well, I love God, but God has never said a word to me about religion. So I figure I'll just go on with what I'm doing. It's like
I think when you were talking, your book coming out is God is Bigger Than the Bible, and I think I had talked to you once about how whenever I hear someone talk about, well, God or Jesus has been kicked out of school. Well, first of all, I think that's rather blasphemous to say you believe in him and you think he's small enough, weak enough to be kicked out of a school. But on the other hand, I know when I was in school, there was a lot of prayer going on. There was prayer when report cards came. There was prayer when didn't get home in time. There was prayer when a girl was late with her period. There was a lot of prayer then. So, there's a lot more prayer going on in schools, let me tell you.
As long as it's not imposed on everybody else.
Yeah.
How are they going to tell anyway if you're praying or not, right?
I don't know. Well, I am going to say good night. Thank you so much, and thanks to everybody out there listening.
Thank you, everybody, so much. I've really enjoyed this.
Well, thank you. And, I'm going to close with my song from my CD that I'm going to send to you. And it's kind of my motto, too. Everybody's got to swing.
Well, when you were the nappy kid, swinging everything you did, you jump and jive and bop and sing, saying everybody's got to swing. But mom and pop were right on time. They helped up all your nerves. When you started off your dream of a jam-tied jitterbug scene.